Bears, bears, cones, spirals, snowflakes, Santas, bugles, apples. He owns them all. Someone made this one for me a long time ago. Isn't it wonderful? Dangling from his fingers is an egg-shaped ornament covered in white and gold brocade, striped with olive green velvet and pearly jewels. It's a copy of a Russian Fabergé egg. Osborne and his assistant, Philip Howard, are preparing to decorate a Christmas tree in the style Osborne would choose for his own home. Osborne, a 57-year-old Christian scientist who neither smokes nor drinks, is slightly bald, has a graying mustache and a deep tan, and owns a Siamese cat named Angel Noel. By profession, he is a custom draper, but he has collected Christmas ornaments for most of his life, and for the last 30 years, he has been in the seasonal business of decorating trees in Houston homes and businesses. Every December, he takes 3 weeks of vacation from his regular job and devotes his time to Christmas trees. He and Howard work with about a dozen different families, including some who have been clients for 25 years, as well as 3 or 4 commercial accounts. The two men deliver trees to a few of those families and just string lights for others. But for most, they do the works. Deliver a perfectly shaped tree, string the lights, and hang all the ornaments. Osborne will even put together a custom ornament collection if the client's own selection is lacking. This year, he is doing a 25-foot tree for the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, using decorations from the collection of almost 3,000 ornaments that art patron Audrey Beck left to the museum, in addition to trees for the Houston Ballet's Nutcracker Market and Cullen Bank. Having a tree decorated by Tom Osborne can cost anywhere from $500 to several thousand dollars. But as he says, I'm the best. If they're shopping for price, they're talking to the wrong guy. It is the private clients who are the most intriguing. It seems as if the point of Christmas, the gathering of family and friends together in a warm holiday spirit, is being missed by people who hire a professional to trim their tree. Osborne, at least, makes an effort to keep the decorating personal, paying close attention to individual tastes. He's very protective of his clients and will characterize them only as the exclusive, precise few. Christine Bellick, another professional tree trimmer, is more illuminating about such clients. She describes them as prominent, active social people who don't have the time or the talent to decorate their tree in the way they want it to be. It's got to be perfect, just like people who don't do their own hair. Though most clients want a tree done because they are throwing a holiday party, their family often gathers to watch as the tree is decorated. Sometimes they even serve Osborne eggnog and cookies. Other times they go out for the evening, anticipating a magical surprise when they return. Osborne specializes in the traditional style, the look that best suits a room full of 18th century furniture. Natural trees trimmed with colored glass ornaments, concave reflectors, and real tinsel icicles. While he is most fond of natural decorations and soft colors, such as plums, pinks, and blues, not red and green, he'll do just about anything asked of him. He has adorned flocked trees. He has created Mexican-themed trees with straw ornaments, brightly colored paper flowers, and gold lights. A 50s tree spray-painted silver and embellished with white lights, mirrored ornaments, and spun glass. A Williamsburg tree trimmed with pine cones, popcorn, candles, and birds. He filled one tree with only stuffed animals, a veritable Noah's Ark tree. After growing up in Beaumont, Osborne had a career as a professional ice skater, then moved on to advertising, and finally to decorating. But he has always been infatuated, even obsessed, with trees. I just love trees, he says. If I had my life to live over again, I would study forestry. He decorated his first Christmas trees at a tender age. When I was a kid, and I found a cut shrub or tree, I would drag it home to decorate. I made Easter trees, Halloween trees, Thanksgiving trees, and at Christmas I'd beg my parents to put up the tree as early as possible. I'd decorate the whole thing once, and then take it all down and start over again. I'd rehang every ornament, each little icicle. Even though Osborne sees his passion as rather obscure, for many florists, interior decorators, and window dressers, tree decorating is a logical extension of their regular businesses. For the last 10 or 15 years, the practice of hiring a professional to trim the tree and deck the halls has been relatively common among wealthy Houston families, and it has increased steadily with the city's affluence. Florists, in particular, are swamped with orders scheduled between the last week of November and Christmas. It's a word-of-mouth operation. Someone sees a window dresser putting up a tree in a store or notices the tree at a friend's Christmas party and asks if she can get hers done next year. Florists like Ben Kruger of Au Naturel and Lyman Ratcliffe have clients lined up and are ordering trees through a local broker by June. They may decorate 8 or as many as 30 trees a season, spending between 4 hours and 2 full days on each tree. One of the best-known florists in Houston, Leonard Tharp, will do your tree if you also want the rest of your house decorated, from the front door to the mantelpiece to the guest bathroom. But if it's only a tree you want, he'll recommend Tom Osborne. "I've never had one this pretty," Osborne says of the tree he has just taken from its burlap wrapping. It's an 8-foot noble fir that was cut just 2 days earlier in a Washington forest and then air freighted to Osborne's tree broker, Barry Jackson, at the Plant Farm in Houston. "This one was hand-picked," Osborne explains. "Usually noble firs aren't so full and a branch is broken or crushed. And you rarely find a noble with a pretty top. See?" He points to the meager twigs at the tree's top. Next to this tree is another one, much smaller and scrawnier, the filler. Because he expects flaws, Osborne always orders a second tree that can be cut up to fill in or plug the larger tree's bare spots. Osborne stands with his hands on his hips, looking the tree over, eyeing the spots where he plans to plug in a branch cut from the spare tree. "This tree needs a fitting," he announces. "Where's the drill?" he asks Howard. Once he finds a gap, Osborne tries out several spare branches by pushing them into the spot and checking for size, color, the shades of green may vary from silver to blue, and variation. The density of the needles will differ depending on what side of the mountain a tree's grown on. Howard steps back to inspect the look. There's a relationship between the height and the width of the tree that you must keep in mind, he says, and he gives Osborne's branch his approval. Howard then drills an angled, inch-deep hole into the trunk of the tree, while Osborne uses a butcher knife to whittle the end of the branch down to size. Then they hot glue the branch into the hole. Sometimes even more major surgery is required. For instance, when a tree isn't as tall as Osborne and Howard want, or when the top isn't full enough, they will stack it. First, they cut the top off and drill a hole inside the center of the trunk. Into the hole, they insert a 6-inch metal dowel. Then they take a taller or prettier top from another tree, drill a matching hole in the center of its trunk, and stick it on the dowel. Of course, it's not going to do the tree any good to water it, when you do that, Howard adds. That's one of the advantages of noble firs. They stay fresh longer, even if they are in two parts. Most of the homes that Osborne and Howard do require a tree 8 to 10 feet tall. Since noble firs of more than 8 feet tall usually aren't as full as Osborne would like, he often buys shorter trees and stacks them. He goes to the extra trouble because noble firs are so beautiful. They're fabulous. They've changed my life. And because they keep their needles. If we were to leave this tree till next year, it would still have its needles, but they'd be terracotta. Douglas firs are better if height is the primary requirement, but Osborne doesn't like them as well because their branches are so soft that they'll barely hold any ornaments. Blue or silver spruces are just lovely, but they lose their needles instantly. You can stand in a room and hear them drop off, and they stick you to death. The long-needled Scotch pines usually have a full shape, but they're so bushy that they can't take as many decorations as Osborne likes to use. The resin of a noble is like perfume, Osborne says adoringly. With all the drilling and whittling going on, a luscious, thick pine fragrance has filled the room. He has now plugged 25 to 30 extra branches into the tree, and it is looking plump and shapely. To the untutored eye, it may seem as balanced and full as it can possibly be, but Osborne and Howard say that every time they add a branch, another gap appears. You can get it too full, Osborne explains as he fluffs the branches. Then I can't get the ornaments in, and I have to go in with scissors and trim it back. I just like to fool with trees forever, torture them to death. As he works, Osborne explains that he usually does the plugging and stacking during the day, out of sight of his clients. They get nervous watching us move things around. After a little more preening, Osborne admits, "Really, it's perfect right now." He's right. The top, which was quite spindly before, is now as full as the rest. If you look close enough, you can see the stitches. He has taped green styrofoam around the very top of the trunk and then stuck in small branches from the other tree. He uses styrofoam because the top of a tree is so thin that if you drill holes in it, it could just fall off. After leveling the tree by sticking little blocks of wood under its stand, Osborne is ready to add the sparkle of lights. He is looking over his group of miniature lights, about 20 sets, all neatly coiled and separated. Daytime is hateful for trees. You can't see the lights, and they lose their magic. Osborne tests each set and leaves it lighted as he weaves the cord through the branches. "The most common mistake, I think," he says as he strings the lights from the bottom of the tree up, pushing them deep toward the back of the branches and gently tugging them forward, "is to put a light on the end of each branch, which is exactly where an ornament should go." He works in small triangular areas. Circling the tree would make the lights too difficult to take down. And he doesn't twist the cords tightly around the branch. That would pull on the needles and take away from the shape of the branch. "Every once in a while, I have to jump back and see what I've done," he says, getting a better perspective. He's got a string of lights roped around his neck. It's good to do the lights in the dark so you can really tell. First he hangs the multicolored lights, and then he goes back in with the solid colored ones. "I'm just mad about those amber lights." "Amber gives the tree a lot of green," he explains, "and the bright white lights are a little too hard-edged. Softer lights are nicer for a residence." Osborne uses miniature Italian lights, but he says the ones made in Taiwan are pretty foolproof. The old-fashioned indoor-outdoor lights with the screw-in bulbs are not for trees anymore, or at least not for his trees. The globes and cords are so heavy that they weigh the branches down. With the lights arranged to perfection, Osborne studies his collection of ornaments. "Excess is better if you have pretty things. We'll get this tree so covered with ornaments you won't see any wires." As he attaches them to the tree, he holds several by their hooks in his teeth and others in each hand. You start with the big ornaments. They go farthest in, and you decorate from the trunk out. It pulls the branch down if you put a big one on the end. The whole idea of the Christmas tree is the shape, and you don't want to lose that with the big ornaments. If a branch does get pulled down from the weight of the lights or an ornament, Osborne hoists it up with the wire from the branch above. He closes the hook of a large coral and gold glittered ball, and then checks to make sure his ornaments are all hanging free. He moves about the tree, and even gets down on the floor to see that he is placing everything properly. The smaller, lighter ornaments dangle on the ends of the branches. "Of course, you put your favorite ones on the front," he says, as he hangs a shiny chartreuse sun prominently. Howard is inclined to place the plain, solid-colored glass balls back inside the tree for color and reflection. "I'm going to the top now." Osborne makes his move before the last ornaments are hung. so he won't bump them off. He climbs up a ladder, and Howard passes him some thin green florist stakes, which Osborne sticks into the styrofoam at the top of the tree. I do a sort of Guadalupe Madonna look at the top. You could call it my signature. Spraying out from the top of his tree are more than 20 finials, jeweled, blown glass globes surmounted by long, tapering points. Putting this many on is simply outrageous. It's gilding the lily, but it's what I love best. Opulence is the name of the game. While he sings, I talk to the trees, but they don't listen to me. Part of a song from Paint Your Wagon, Tom Osborne applies the finishing touches, real tinsel icicles from Bavaria, to his tree. I could just go on forever, he says, searching for another spot to garnish. But there are no more spots. He's covered them all. Finally, Osborne stands back, admiring his work. I think it's one of the nicest I've ever done. It is a beautiful tree, glistening with color and sparkle, and somehow reminiscent of Tom Osborne, who, in a contemplative moment, says, It's a shame this business has come my way. Really, people need more family-centered things to be happier.
On the housetop, reindeer paws. Out jumps good old Santa Claus. Down through the chimney with lots of toys. All for the little one's Christmas joy.
Hi, this is Jack. Here's an article from the December 1983 issue of Texas Monthly entitled Texas Primer, Christmas on the Range. Deck the halls with cedar and red chilies. By Ann Dingus. Christmas Eve fell as balmy as April, wrote O. Henry in 1903, thereby summing up the distinguishing mark of a Texas Christmas. It's hot. O. Henry didn't know the blizzardy side of the state, living as he did in the south of it, but he knew that few native Texans witness many white Christmases. Most of us resign ourselves to green ones. Unless we live in East Texas, where pines are native, we have to buy our Christmas trees from the Optimist Club. Without fireplaces, we lack the proper place to hang stockings, roast chestnuts, well, pecans then, and look for boot prints in the morning ashes. It makes us a little wistful, but we have faced the inescapable truth. The Christmas of Currier and Ives will never be ours. Luckily, over the years, we have created traditions of our own. In the case of the Christmas tree, our forebears used cedar, a pestilent plant that had never before done anyone much good. A.C. Green recalls childhood trips to fetch the least lopsided and wind-whipped tree. If cedar was unavailable, a sapling, tumbleweed, or cactus might serve. Decorations varied, popcorn garlands, candles, strings of red chilies and garlic. On top, of course, was a lone star. Texas does have mistletoe, which, like cedar, is a nuisance that redeems itself only in December. All over the state you can spot mistletoe snippers gingerly scaling barbed wire to cut branches from beleaguered mesquites by the side of the road. The familiar shrub with its pearly berries must have provided European immigrants with a welcome reminder of home. In addition to Christmas kisses under the mistletoe, immigrants brought to Texas a wealth of other customs. The Germans offered Kris Kringle and Pfeffernusses and caroling. Around the original German settlements, you could still hear the words Stillnacht, Heilignacht, sung to a well-known melody. Mexico gave us buñuelos, poinsettias, and luminarias, those lanterns made of candles inside sand-weighted paper bags. Bright Mexican goods and decorations, which seem so gaudy most of the year, fit right in at Christmas time. Our most influential culture, though, was that of the cowboy. The range life was a solitary one, and holidays meant a rare chance to socialize. Most towns held a dance, and cowboys would ride all day to attend. Caroling was a mite civilized for early Texas tastes, so cowboys initiated the Christmas serenade, a chivalry-like procession whose sole purpose was to make a huge commotion. On Christmas morning, they settled down long enough for a church service or a few impromptu prayers. For all their horseplay, cowboys were believers. Later in the day, married couples invited the men for revelry and chow. They reciprocated by smuggling in trinkets for the children, who surely redoubled their faith in Santa when goodies miraculously appeared in their stockings, with not a store for miles. Texas kids, J. Evetts Haley wrote, knew exactly what Santa's sled and reindeer looked like. After all, they grew up around harness and livestock. Not so commonplace on the frontier was overindulgence, but during the holidays, even thrifty Texans enjoyed this most universal of Christmas traditions. Cooks cheerfully used up hoards of dried fruit and sugar to make treats like fruitcake, an old Texas favorite, but the real delicacies were fresh foods brought in for the occasion. Bertha McKee Dobie remembered her father's once asking the name of that vegetable that is shipped in at Christmas. It was celery. Eggs went for eggnog. Oranges were sugar plums. The high point of any gathering might well have been the whiskey, for Christmas was one day when drinking could be done in public and to excess. Excess has become a Texas tradition, too. We always try to be the biggest, the noisiest, the best. We string colored lights on everything from fences to pump jacks, drink Noche Buena instead of wassail, and ring cowbells instead of sleigh bells. Who needs snow-covered pine trees anyway? They just block out the stars in our big December sky.
Santa baby, slip a sable under the tree for me. Been an awful good girl, Santa baby, and hurry down the chimney tonight.
Hi, this is Caitlin. I'm reading a Texas Monthly article, The Texanist. Our advice columnist muses on the sanctity of a pickup's bed, browses the Neiman Marcus Christmas book, and once again tries to determine who qualifies as a Texan. By David Courtney. Issue from December of 2015. Question. Does anyone ever purchase the super crazy high-dollar gifts from the Neiman Marcus Christmas catalog? Petra Carson, Fort Worth. Answer. The Texanist is one of those gift givers for whom mail-order catalogs are completely useless. The Texanist is a procrastinator. Despite resolution upon resolution upon resolution to change his ways, the magnet-like pull of life's various distractions, Franklin Barbecue and its famous long line, football season, 254 pretty country courthouse Christmas lights displays, etc., inevitably results in a mad gingerbread and eggnog-fueled Christmas Eve gift-buying blitz. Catalog purchases would never arrive at their destinations at this late hour. Hey, something just crossed the Texanist's mind. Please, if you will, bear with him for a moment longer while he conducts some more introspection. It occurs to him that this is just the sort of flaw that may have caused the ability to afford the likes of the fantasy gifts featured in Neiman Marcus's annual Christmas book to elude him all these years. Even if the Texanist were a little fatter in the wallet, he's not sure who on his list would be interested in the $150,000 motorcycle and included ride along the California coast with actor Keanu Reeves, Dangerous Liaisons, from this year's offerings? Or who would deserve one of the $95,000 Neiman Marcus Limited Edition Ford Mustang convertibles? Or the $90,000 100,000-foot elevation World View Exploration at the Edge of Space balloon ride? Or the $30,000 Billy Gibbons designed guitar to be presented by Gibbons backstage at one of his concerts? But this isn't about the Texanist's yet-to-be-made naughty and nice list. Ginger Reader, the kind Neiman's elf responsible for the fantasy gifts, told the Texanist that each of the outrageous items he just mentioned, despite the fact that it was only October when he reached out to her, had already been purchased. Speaking of fantasies, the Texanist was just thinking, as he was pursuing the Christmas book while mulling your missive, that it would really be something if a mysterious old heiress, acting on a whim, purchased the $125,000 Orphan Barrel Project, whiskey experience, and its 24 bottles of exceptionally rare bourbon from page 38, and had it sent to the Texanist, care of Texas Monthly, P.O. Box 1569, Austin, Texas, 78767-1569.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Hi, this is Linda. The Great Piramda. A German Christian tradition brightens the holidays in Texas, by Lon Taylor. Published in the December 2015 issue of Texas Monthly. In the tumultuous years between 1830 and 1860, about 20,000 Germans immigrated to Texas. They left their homeland because of its poor economic conditions, and they were drawn to Texas by the availability of large tracts of cheap land. By simply paying the title fees, immigrants could acquire more land than was ruled over by some German princes. The first wave of immigrants settled in the lower valleys of the Brazos and Colorado Rivers in what is now Austin, Fayette, and Colorado counties. Others founded the towns of New Braunfels and Fredericksburg and spread out across the hill country. By 1860, German-speaking Texans predominated in these two regions. They brought with them their language, their customs, and their love of music. Most German communities in Texas established a Stadtkapelle, or town band. Many had a Gesangverein, a choral singing society. During the latter half of the 19th century, in a little community in Fayette County called Waldeck, the Stadtkapelle was the Schumann Band. The band was started by three brothers, Karl, Gotthelf, and Christian Schumann, who had emigrated from the Saxon village of Oberscheibe in the Erzgebirge Mountains with their wives and children in 1853. By the 1880s, the band included Karl's son Emil, Gotthelf's sons Gustav and Paul, and Christian's son Adolf. The family performed at weddings and dances in Waldeck and the surrounding communities, and they played at the dedication of the state capitol in Austin. The Schumann brothers' village in Germany was a mining town, the home of the famous Walter Abraham iron mine, which opened in 1677. But mining provided uncertain employment in the Erzgebirge region, and the miners traditionally supplemented their income by carving wooden toys such as nutcrackers, soldiers, and animals. One of the most ornate forms of Erzgebirge carving was the pyramide, a sort of multi-story carousel in which a series of discs decorated with carved figures was attached to a central axle and rotated as the heat from candles turned a propeller on the top of the axle. These pyramids were made in all sizes, from tabletop ornaments to large structures erected in town squares during Christmas. Sometime in the 1870s, Emil sat down to make a pyramid. Emil was born in Waldeck in 1856 and had never been to Germany. No one knows what he used as a model. Perhaps his parents had brought a small pyramid with them from Saxony, or perhaps he had used a picture of one in a town square that his family had. His pyramid is about 3 feet high and 2.5 feet wide, with a domed building surmounted by a cupola, perhaps inspired by a town hall. The building is supported by a papier-mâché mountain. Three rotating circular platforms laden with carved figures are powered by the heat from 13 oil lamps attached to the building and the mountain. The lower platform, which rotates inside the mountain itself, carries 8 miniature miners, some pushing carts full of ore and some carrying axes over their shoulders. The middle platform features blue-coated soldiers carrying rifles with bayonets at shoulder arms, who march through the building's first floor. Uniformed bandsmen and a bandmaster occupy the top platform on the building's second floor. Carved pine and palm trees and fanciful wooden figures fill a fenced yard in front of the building. A soldier guards the gate. A shepherd with a crook herds a flock of sheep. A hunter aims his gun at a deer. 3 dogs and a leopard roam, and a squirrel looks down from a tree. The mountain is made from a German-language Galveston newspaper, on which the date 1872 is visible from the inside. Emil devoted his life to music. He never married, and he disliked farming, hiring a black worker named Lufkin Shelby to till his land while he composed music and taught piano, organ, and concertina. He owned 2 organs and several concertinas, one of which family legend says he wished to be buried with. Emil displayed his pyramid only once a year during the Christmas holidays. He would set it up in his living room, light the lamps, and sit beside it playing Christmas carols on his concertina to the delight of his nieces and nephews and all the other children in Waldeck. When Emil died in 1937, he left Shelby 50 acres of land, and one of Emil's nephews, Robert Wenzel, inherited the pyramid. He kept it in the crate that Emil had built for it at his home in Seguin for more than 30 years. After Wenzel's death in 1969, his widow, Anna, wrote Imahog, the noted philanthropist and art collector, telling her about the pyramid. Hogg was assembling a collection of Texas folk art for an exhibit in Wynedale, the historic property near Round Top that she had given to the University of Texas at Austin in 1967. Hogg immediately went to Seguin, saw the pyramid, and acquired it. It has been on exhibit at Wynedale ever since. Historian Cecilia Steinfeld, known as the First Lady of Texas Art, described it as one of the finest pieces of folk art ever made in the Lone Star State.
You better watch out, you better not cry, you better not pout, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town.
This is Kay, reading from the Texas Monthly Archives. Santa Speaks. Every Day is Christmas for Claus Clone Carl Anderson by Helen Thompson from the December 1991 issue. Carl Anderson passes the beard test and makes believers out of young and old alike. Photo by Bill Albrecht. For most of the year, Carl Anderson, unlike most of his peers in the Santa Claus trade, takes his role very seriously. Anderson, who entertains kiddies at North Park Center in Dallas from Thanksgiving to Christmas, maintains his beard year-round. The jolly psychologist from Austin even wrote his dissertation on what happens when children decide not to believe in old Saint Nick. Here are his observations on being the big guy. Santa is the true sense of unconditional love. He loves kids and loves being with kids. He's an eternally good parent. He represents that aspect in all of us for generosity. Not all homes in Texas have chimneys because it's not cold like at the North Pole. For those that don't, I tell the children to leave holly at the entrance they want me to use. For those that do, I tell them to put out the fire. Kids talk about what they're going to leave me on Christmas Eve. One boy said, "I've been thinking about it, and I'm going to leave you a little trash can." Then a girl told me to take off my shoes because I made a mess last time.
Sleigh bells ring, are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight, walking in the winter wonderland.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from Texas Monthly, the December 2001 edition. This article is entitled "Merry Texmas" by Ann Dingus. How did early Texans celebrate the holidays? With air-splitting explosions, round-the-clock revels, and homemade hooch. If you want to experience a real old-fashioned Texas Christmas, make sure you're equipped with gunpowder, moonshine, and adequate health insurance. For its first century, the state celebrated a holiday that was short on snow, sugar plums, and other Dickensian trimmings. But there was no lack of fireplaces or family togetherness, then known as cabin fever, and dozens of do-it-yourself diversions were readily available in the godforsaken wilderness that was then Texas. For example, noise. It was cheap and easy to produce, and making it is arguably the state's oldest holiday tradition. Frederick Law Olmsted, who visited Texas in 1853, described San Augustine's Christmas serenade. A band of pleasant spirits started from the square, blowing tin horns and beating tin pans, and visited in succession every house in the village, kicking in doors, pulling down fences. Locals forgave the vandalism. After all, it was Christmas. Later on, the increasing availability of gunpowder made recreational explosions a popular tradition. Pranksters of all ages, but a single gender no doubt, poured it into dead trees or holes in the ground, then lit a fuse and ran. A particularly dangerous variation on this perilous pastime was the anvil shoot, a tradition that exemplifies natural selection at work. Two anvils were stacked, one on top of the other, with a layer of gunpowder in between. Then the bravest participant lit the fuse. The point was not how high the top anvil flew, but how loud the roar was. With luck, it carried glad tidings to neighbors miles away. Eventually, mass-produced fireworks made the requisite holiday clamor easier to achieve, but no less risky. In her 1894 memoir of Ranch Life Near Junction, Mary J. Jaques observed that the fame of our Roman candles, rockets, and fire balloons spread in due course as far as San Antonio. But after the display, we discovered that the roof of the gallery was on fire. One factor that allowed outdoor pyrotechnics to become a Texas Christmas tradition was the weather. Although the Panhandle, for example, regularly endured killer blizzards, most of the state was mild, even hot on Christmas Day. In 1867, according to a San Antonio paper, the weather was too warm and the eggnogs were spoiled. In Star of Hope, a Yuletide story set in 30s Houston, William Goya noted that the sun blazed down and electric fans were on. Historian Joe B. France, born in Dallas in 1917, wrote, "I never saw a white Christmas until I was 58 years old, and that was in Munich, Germany." Sometimes the holiday noise was joyful. The first Noel in these parts was observed, probably with prayer and hymns, as early as 1528, when Spanish explorer Cabeza de Vaca and three of his men were holding body and soul together on the Texas coast, near what is now called, ironically enough, Christmas Bay. In 1686, his French equivalent, La Salle, spent the day in the same region. San Antonio's San Fernando Cathedral has celebrated Christmas Eve Mass since the 1730s. What is now termed an interfaith service was once standard practice. In 1852, a young Catholic priest named Emmanuel Domenic wrote that he had conducted a Brownsville service for a crowd of every age, sex, and creed. But Protestant churches sprang up quickly. On December 25, 1858, eight men and women in a Matagorda schoolroom were the first Episcopalians in the nation to take Holy Communion. Natives and immigrants of all ethnicities enjoyed that enduring classic, the Christmas party, especially if someone was fortunate enough to own a musical instrument. Such pioneer virtuosos were the linchpins of yesteryear's social gatherings. Though the truly essential element, at least until the 20th century, was female dance partners. In 1882, Lizzie Campbell, the mistress of the Matador Ranch, enlisted the help of the resident cook, who scraped his fiddle at her annual Christmas bash. She invited some 50 cowboys, then having a warm heart and a strong sense of self-preservation. She also arranged for five other women to attend, the closest of whom lived 70 miles away. The merrymakers tripped the light fantastic for long and weary hours, one chronicler noted. A particularly famous shebang was the one in Anson, which in 1885 inspired New York Times reporter Larry Chittenden to immortalize the event in his poem, The Cowboys' Christmas Ball. Of course, the town of Anson was in Wild West Texas. In the 1880s, sophisticated Galveston saw many a ritzy affair breathlessly detailed in society columns. Mrs. Short Willis wore brown velvet, pink roses, and diamond ornaments. And San Antonio's elegant Menger Hotel served a Christmas repast that included Benwick Bay oysters, baked fillet of trout au gratin, and prime beef with Yorkshire pudding. But regular old Texans feasted on game, simply because there wasn't much else around. Vegetarian was a swear word back then. Jack Elgin, traveling with surveyors in West Texas in 1872, stuffed himself at a Christmas dinner. We had buffalo, antelope, deer, bear, rabbit, prairie dog, possum, and possibly other animals that I do not recall. Turkey, goose, brant, ducks, prairie chicken, curlew, quail, and other birds. He added that one of our hunters offered to furnish us with a mess of rattlesnakes and polecats, which he assured us were a most excellent delicacy, but our cook drew the line at these. Novelist Elith Hamilton Kirkland, who was born in Coleman in 1907, celebrated less carnivorous Christmases enjoying once a year fruit and nut treats, such as apples, oranges, bananas, walnuts, and coconuts. Texas fruitcake bakers traditionally substituted watermelon rind pickles for genuine citron, and they sorely missed fresh eggs and milk. One Texas wife lamented that her only ingredient for a holiday cake was sheer sweet ozone. Eggs and milk were also necessary for making the ultimate Christmas beverage, eggnog. But to Texans, they weren't as essential as whiskey, which a German visitor characterized in 1845 as the national drink here with which Christmas is celebrated. The so-called white mule was fiery and raw, distressing an English traveler who complained around Christmas 1839 that it made for eggnog of a very bilious nature. Soldiers were especially famous for cutting loose at Christmas. H.H. McConnell, on duty at Fort Belknap and Fort Richardson in the 1860s, despaired of the 1,001 ways and means that a soldier will indulge in to get whiskey. Except for pink elephants, there weren't that many colorful Christmas ornaments way back when. German immigrants, shocked that the primitive Texans had never heard of a Christmas tree, introduced the tradition to the Republic, and in a few decades, trimming a tree became de rigueur. In 1882, the Austin Statesman advised, "Christmas trees are now in order. If you cannot pay $2 for one, take a hatchet, go out in the wood, and poach on somebody's forest." This was standard practice. Even as late as 1947, the Texas Forest Service offered tips for harvesting the state's unlimited supplies of evergreen ropings and buried branches. In some areas, a tree was much harder to come by. In 1890, a Wellington ranch wife recalled having to settle for a miserable little stunted cedar. Since shiny glass globes and other mass-produced ornaments were nowhere to be found, she adorned her scrubby tree with bits of leftover calico and tinsel made from foil peeled off chewing tobacco pouches. Eventually, Texans would borrow many Mexican holiday traditions, such as piñatas. The traditional star-like shape was a particularly fitting choice for a Texas Christmas. And luminarias, the sand-filled paper bags that hold lighted candles and are used to line walkways and porches. Mexico also gave us the poinsettia, a.k.a. La Flor de Nochebuena, or the Christmas Eve flower, and edibles like tamales and sweet cinnamony buñuelos. Then there was the problem of presents in the past. Pioneer kids usually found in their stockings homemade gifts such as rag dolls or hand-carved tops. Evelyn Miller Crowell, who grew up near Dallas, recorded in her memoirs that in 1904, when she was five, her presents from Santa included a doll, a miniature stove with pots and dishes, a beaded purse, and books and books and books. In 1865, when Major General George Custer was stationed in Austin, he gave his younger brother Tom a jew's harp with a note to give the piano a rest. Even as stores became bigger and better supplied, by today's standards, the choice of goods was limited. Novelist Benjamin Capps recalled that for Christmas 1929, when he was seven, he gave his mother a new spatula. Some gifts were even more memorable. On December 25, 1907, in the hamlet of Voth, a young couple was blessed with a baby boy, Glenn Herbert McCarthy, who 40 years later was a rich and famously flashy wildcatter. And no real-life Santa was ever more generous than Fort Worth's Tom Wagoner, who on Christmas Day 1909 divided up half of his million-acre ranch among his three children. Miscellaneous entertainments rounded out the holidays. Blowing up hog bladder balloons, for instance, or chasing livestock down Main Street. You had to do something special. We all shaved and greased up with bear oil for Christmas, one of a party of bachelor cowboys noted ruefully in the late 19th century. The only thing we could think of doing. Ranch hands frequently imitated medieval knights and put on rodeo-style tournaments. Amateur talent shows were also popular. The more highfalutin, the better. Florence Fenley of Uvalde participated in carol fests and literary soirees in the 1880s. We were just as liable to spring Tennyson on them as some lesser poet, and if the audience didn't understand or hear a word, they applauded heartily. Having fun, especially at holidays, is a Texas specialty. A determination to make the best of everything, come what may, is one tradition well worth preserving. In 1909, an East Texas man recalled a particularly unpromising holiday of his childhood. A Merry Christmas in the dark and dreary days of 1864 seemed almost impossible in Texas, where the pangs of war were so keenly felt. But we had always observed Christmas in the family and could not abandon a time-honored custom. Yes, we were going to have a Merry Christmas, in spite of the unpropitious surroundings.
Feliz Navidad, prospero año y felicidad.
Hello, this is Cindy, the Texanist. What's the deal with tamales and Christmas? A Dallasite wonders how something so tasty, so filling, and so pre-Christian came to be a holiday staple. Question. I've lived in Texas my whole life, all 43 years, right here in the Lone Star State. Except for the first couple of years when I didn't know better, I have been a lover of all Tex-Mex foods. Strangely, until this year, I never knew that tamales had some sort of Christmas connection. What exactly is the deal with Christmas and tamales? Charlie Hodge, Dallas. Answer. Among all the world's gastronomic traditions, is there one that is more delectable than that of Mexico? The Texanist, an admittedly rabid devotee of most all foodstuffs, originating south of the border, is certain that there is not. One of the stars of the Mexican kitchen, as well as the Tex-Mex kitchen, is the tamale, a delicious treat made with masa and a filling of the tamaleras, tamale makers, choosing. There's beef, chicken, bean and cheese, squash, sweet corn, and on and on and on. The tamale options are infinite. The Texanist's favorite is the classic pork variety. Glistening and slippery, they are the quintessential tamale, and the Texanist is known to devour fistfuls of the slick little devils throughout the year. Mm-mm. Washed down with a big red or some cold Mexican suds, there's nothing like it. The debt of gratitude for the invention of the tamale is owed to the great Mesoamerican cultures of millennia past. The Aztec, Maya, Mixtec, Olmec, Toltec, and the Zapotec all took nourishment from the small banana leaf or corn husk wrapped packets of goodness, and each passed down their tamale customs through the generations. Interestingly, though, and to the point of your query, none of these ancient cultures were known to have celebrated Christmas. Indeed, some of them predated the birth of Christianity, and none of them had even heard of Christmas before the Europeans arrived in the early 16th century. These peoples did observe their own traditions and celebrations, some of which involved sacrificial offerings, sometimes human, to their deities. There's a theory that has such gruesome gifts being replaced at some point with a much more civilized option, tamales. The likes of Xochipilli, Tenochtitli, and Ah-Kanchil must have been very grateful for the change. The Texanist knows he certainly would have been were he an ancient god. The thinking is that over time, tamales became associated with special occasions, and as the Mexican population was eventually Christianized, the tradition was transferred to the most important holiday on the Christian calendar, which is why, come the holiday season, it is common for Mexican, Mexican-Texan, and Mexican-American families and friends to gather in kitchens big and small for annual tamaladas, or tamale-making parties. The fruits of such gatherings, the dozens upon dozens of delicious tamales, are then divvied up and dispersed to friends, co-workers, and loved ones far and wide. Christmas time in Texas means it's also tamale time in Texas. Can the Texanists get a great big hallelujah? Still, as interesting as this history is, the important thing, the thing that really matters, the thing to appreciate is not how this tradition came about as much as that the tradition came about. Is the Texanist right? Feliz Navidad, and may God and all the tamaleras bless us, everyone, with lots of tamales.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear recording library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Senior Notes, followed by the History Book Hour at 9.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
Starbright Village. Despite a nearly year-long pandemic, the trees will twinkle, the lights will shine brightly, and baby Jesus will warmly greet visitors as the annual Starbright Village kicks off with a virtual tree lighting ceremony December 3rd. The popular holiday attraction, which draws more than 200,000 visitors every year, will be on display through January 1st.
As we head towards Christmas, Recording Library of West Texas Radio is ready to put you into the spirit of the season with Christmas music. Weekday afternoons following the coronavirus update, we'll spend the remainder of the 1 o'clock hour with Christmas classics, as well as a few newer favorites. Happy holidays from all of us at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 50 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-40s. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 60s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the low 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Hi folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on the holiday lights of the Make-Believe Ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for a special edition of the most beloved holiday music of the 1930s and 1940s. You know folks, American tastes have drastically changed over the decades, yet our Christmas songbook has remained largely the same. The most played and most beloved Christmas songs date from the 1930s and a couple of decades thereafter. The studio is all decorated. I have a hot chocolate next to me on the Crystal Studio console. So let's sit back and bring back memories of holidays past.
Mr. Murphy, I'm glad to be back in this festivity.
Ah, you said it, Mr. T. It's Christmas night in Harlem.
When a
Hi, folks. I am indeed Jeff Bressler, and again, welcome to the Make Believe Ballroom Holiday Special. In the background of the opening, I played a portion of Paul Whiteman's version of Christmas Night in Harlem. And throughout the show today, I am going to play some wonderful Christmas and holiday tunes and discuss why the 1930s and the 1940s was so special to the music of the season and so beloved that we still listen to that music and enjoy it to this very day. Let's get things underway with one you might never have heard. How about we return to 1936? Louis Prima and his orchestra. What will Santa Claus say when he finds everybody swinging? A new rising interest in Christmas and holiday music emerged in the 1930s that put an indelible imprint on our culture. An annual analysis of the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, better known as ASCAP, found that 16 of the 25 most popular Christmas songs in 2019 dated from the 30s, 40s, or 50s. This era was a high point of American popular music generally, when the quality of the lyrics and of the music was exceptional, and we still hear it, and we still love it, in the most recognizable Christmas songs. Christmas songs from much earlier were dusted off and made into standards. None is more iconic than Jingle Bells, which has done much to define our image of Christmas. Written by James Pierpont in the mid-19th century as a song for, believe it or not, the Thanksgiving holiday. It became associated with Christmas, despite making absolutely no reference to the holiday. So let's open our first holiday gift with Benny Goodman and his orchestra, with a great Fletcher Henderson arrangement of the Wintertime Standard, recorded on Victor in New York City, July the 1st, 1935. Boogie Santa Claus is a song that was written by Leon René. The song was recorded with Mabel Scott in late 1947 for Supreme Records and placed within the top 15 of Billboard's charts. Strangely, Patti Page covered the song to little attention in 1950, but its B-side, Tennessee Waltz, became a number one hit in the United States and is one of Patti Page's best-known works. For our next present, though, let's open the wrapping on Mabel Scott and Boogie Woogie Santa.
Well, look here, Jack is jumping down the track. He's got a rhythm in his feet, but nothing in his back. He's a Boogie Woogie Santa Claus. The Boogie Woogie Santa Claus, the Boogie Woogie Santa comes to town every Christmas day. He lives up in the mountains like a hermit in a cave. He never had a haircut and he never took a shave. He's the Boogie Woogie Santa Claus, the Boogie Woogie Santa Claus, the Boogie Woogie Santa will boogie all your blues away. A candy for your socks, but when he starts to boogie, the whole